This is a download from the BBC.
Welcome to The Forum, a world of ideas from the BBC. Hello, I'm Samira Ahmed. Today, how do we make judgments about ourselves and about others, and could we make better ones? There are few people better equipped to answer this question than our guests this week. In our studio, we have Daniel Kahneman, an American-Israeli psychologist, one of the few non-economists to win a Nobel Prize in economics. Nairi Woods is from New Zealand. She's a world authority on financial governance and has just become Dean of Oxford University's Blavatnik School of Governance. And Julian Baggini is a British philosopher who's written widely on our sense of self, and he joins us from Madrid. Daniel, let's turn to you first. World-renowned psychologist, you spent a lifetime evaluating our bad decisions, the choices that we make that are not in our best interests. And your ideas seem to be so influential because you expose human behaviour for how impulsive and emotional it really is, not at all the rational decision-making that many economists seem to think we use. And you say the key to understanding human behaviour is that we have two selves, our experiencing self and our remembering self. Could you explain this kind of tug of war?
Let me start with a story, which is a true story. Recently, I gave a talk about well-being, and somebody came up at the end with a question, and he told a story, and the story was this, that he said, I recently listened to a symphony, and it was absolutely marvelous. And just toward the end of the symphony, there was that horrible screeching sound. And he added, and this ruined the whole experience. And this seemed to make sense to the audience, but actually it doesn't make any sense at all. He had had the experience. What the screeching sound did, it ruined the memory. And there is a real difference when you look at the consequences of our action. If you look at the actual experience as it runs over time, or at the memory that we keep of it.
And does that mean then that we seem to be thinking more about our future self rather than living for the present, for the experience?
Well, the only thing that we keep from our past are memories, you know. And when we anticipate the future, rather than anticipating experiences, we very frequently anticipate how we will remember these experiences. This is probably why tourists take so many pictures, because they are planning what their remembering self will do with these experiences.
You've hinted at something I wanted you to set as a kind of challenge for our guests, not just around our virtual table, but our listeners across the globe as well, to help us further understand this idea of the two selves. You write in your book about the judgments we make that help us choose a holiday. Explain how that works.
The main difference between what I call the experiencing self and the remembering self is that the remembering self makes up stories. And stories inherently are quite insensitive to how long things take. They're about events. The experiencing self, when we try to construe it and evaluate it and evaluate whether it is happy or not, that experience extends over time. Now think about a vacation that you are planning and imagine that at the end of the vacation you will be given a medicine that wipes out all your memories of the vacation. And furthermore, all the film you will take will be destroyed. Now, if you imagine that, would you still choose the same vacation or would you choose a different vacation?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I just wonder then, is our remembering self more about our status? Because we choose holidays partly so we can tell people about them rather than perhaps just about having a contented, relaxing time.
Well, I'm not sure that it's necessarily about status. Our remembering self is about the quality of our memories. And if we're constructing memories, we want them to be rich, we want them to be distinctive, and we want a lot of them. We want a lot of different memories. Experience could be quite different. It may well be that for experience, what is familiar and what you like and being comfortable with people you like actually yields a happier experience, although it doesn't yield much by way of distinctive memories.
Do you think the implications of your research teach us anything for how governments should think about making decisions for, you know, us irrational people and our remembering selves?
There is another important distinction that must be drawn between two ways in which people think, which is not quite the same as the remembering and experiencing self. And this is we think sometimes fast and sometimes slow. And fast thinking is automatic. It's immediate. It is how we form impressions of the world. When I say 2 + 2, something occurred to you. This is fast thinking. When I say 17 times 24, nothing comes to your mind, probably, except that you recognize it as a multiplication problem. But in order to solve it, you would have to think deliberately. You would have to exert a great deal of effort. And I call those two ways of thinking, I call them System 1 and System 2. And System 1 is fast. System 1 really carries us through the day. System 2 is slower. It is more reflective. We greatly exaggerate the role of System 2 in our life because most of the time, System 2, the decision that we make, are really dictated by the impressions and the intuition that we have. But System 2 is too slow. We couldn't live by System 2. If we tried to live a reasonable life, reasoning and thinking about everything, we couldn't do it.
Wondering what our other guests think. Nairi, what do you make of the ideas that Daniel's explained?
Well, I think they shed real light on problems that governments and politicians do have, because on the one hand, politicians struggle with, and policymakers struggle with, their own intuitive reaction to a problem. You know, I once knew a lady and that's what worked for her, which counters all the statistical evidence that their researchers might be putting in front of them. So that's the sort of first step they have to make, is actually taking the evidence into account in a serious way. But then once they've decided what they ought to do, they then have to speak to an electorate and speak to a community in a way that that community goes, aha, yes, I get it. That's why we're doing this. And so all the incentive is to go with the first simple intuition, because that's what they get and that's what they think the voters and community will get. Whereas to bring in the thinking bit, the evidence, the type 2 thinking, requires them to stop and think harder, and then also to be able to translate that into a language which communities can understand and intuitively feel an affinity to. And that's why I think some of the world's very successful politicians say, if it's not simple, it won't work. But simple doesn't necessarily mean just the kind of fast-thinking intuition. It can mean mixing the fast-thinking with the slow-thinking, but then finding a simple, clear, intuitive way to express it. I think that's the challenge for politicians.
Yes, I mean, it turns out that the public itself wants intuitive decision-makers. It seems that the public, if, you know, the same decision was to be made by two leaders, and one was made slowly and by very thorough reasoning, and the other being made, you know, as George Bush made some of his decision by following his gut, the public, I think, likes decisive decision makers. The public likes fast decisions. And it doesn't support very reasoned statistical reasoning. So sometimes the public encourages leaders to go with their worst intuitions.
Although it's interesting, because in different countries, of course, we see that very differently. So if you wanted to line up fast and slow, you'd probably line up the US on one end and China on the other, right? Where in the Chinese government, they amass all the data, all the evidence. They put extraordinary resources into really drilling through the evidence and coming up with decisions that aren't necessarily associated with any individual, but are the government's decisions. And we could say, yes, but of course, the Chinese people don't get to vote. Their government's in, and they would react differently if they did. But if we look at the Pew Foundation World Survey or the surveys of people, we find that actually a very large number of Chinese citizens, they might not like their government, but they have confidence that it'll make the right decisions, which is a very interesting finding. And a very small percentage of Americans have confidence that their government will make the right decisions.
Let me bring in Julian. What do you make of the ideas you've heard?
Well, there's lots, but I mean, just to follow up on this one, the System 1, System 2, thinking fast and slow, I think as Nairi's already suggested, I mean, is it not the case, Danny, that perhaps, you know, these things, they do work together, don't they? I mean, for example, even if you amass all the evidence and go through it as carefully as possible, there always comes a point where you have to kind of make a judgment. And often that final judgment is not something that just springs out of the data as an inevitable conclusion. You know, the two experts can look at the same charts, the same everything, and still reach a different judgment about what has to come at the end. So is there perhaps always an interaction between between these two things? And perhaps one of the things that people might get wrong about hearing about System 1 and System 2 is that they come to think of them as being more necessarily distinct than in fact that they are in practice.
Of course, every action that we take involves both System 1 and System 2. I mean, it involves some deliberate thinking, and so there always is deliberate thinking. The question is really whether you're responding to the facts or you're responding and really following suggestions that come from somewhere else, that come from fast thinking. What we can see, for example, really within democracies or in the United States, the Iraq War is, of course, the example that everyone is thinking about. You can see the whole machinery of government being, in a way, co-opted to follow the intuitions of a few leaders. So that, when you look at it in the broad picture, there is a lot of reasoning, there is a lot of system too, but it seems to be guided by the intuitions of a few people, listening to their gut and looking at people's, trying to look at people's eyes and see their souls. So, of course, there is System 1 and System 2, but quite frequently we can tell which is really in charge. I find the description that Naira gave of Chinese decision-making fascinating, because there is that stereotype, you know, that democracies are more advanced and so on. But what you're describing, you can see, certainly listening to you, why the Chinese are not terribly impressed by democracy. Well, certainly the Chinese leaders are not impressed by democracy.
But I'm really interested, Daniel, how you place expert intuition into this equation. Because, you know, expert intuition is this idea that some of what we call gut instincts, they're not emotional in the sense that they're not based on non-rational factors. They're a kind of an absorption of knowledge from experience, which gives people a kind of an ability to make decisions quickly, perhaps. I don't know if it's using your system too, but in ways which actually are informed by deep knowledge of experience. And that seems to be something which is important. And when you try and do things purely by flowcharts and the like, you often make the wrong decisions because you don't allow that in. So, I mean, it's a genuine question for me here. How does that expert intuition, which seems to be a good thing, if used properly, fit into the System 1, System 2?
It actually fits in very well, because there is a claim, certainly that's a claim that I develop at some length, that expert intuition, there are conditions for the development of genuine expert intuition. You have to have a lot of practice with immediate reinforcement telling you what is right and wrong. And so that is the case for chess players. They get immediate feedback. To some extent, it is true for poker players. It is true for physicians. It is more true for anesthesiologists than it is for radiologists, because anesthesiologists, they know when they're doing something wrong because they get immediate consequences. Now, it is not true of people thinking about the future of the Middle East. They don't have that kind of experience.
But is it not true of politicians such as, I mean, Churchill, you know, Britain's wartime leader, famously had all this experience, and only really it all came together, didn't it?
You know, you have to really distinguish between various topics on which Churchill did and did not have experience. He had considerable experience as a leader of people. I think he didn't have very much experience and feedback as a strategic leader. I mean, his experiences in World War I were not terribly successful. He didn't have very many. It turned out they were successful, and so we give him quite possibly more credit than he truly deserves.
But also, Danny's just said something I think really powerful about experience, which is the need to get accurate, immediate feedback. And if there's one thing that modern democracy is failing on, it's that. It's that we find that the way people vote is not usually very well correlated with how seriously and with what experience and accuracy politicians are making decisions. And so, although democracy should in theory be extraordinarily responsive and accountable, in fact what we see is that it's not. And you've given us an interesting reason for why that's not the case.
Yes,
because
if
the politician builds up his or her experience without ever getting accurate feedback on what they're getting right and what they're getting wrong in the same way as the anaesthetist, then they're not building expert judgment.
They can't, because feedback on political actions and in fact on major economic actions is very much delayed. And to some extent, the world is also so chaotic that in economic decision-making, for example, in the stock market, I do not believe there is expertise. So people feel expertise, they feel very confident, but the world is chaotic. And so their forecasts and their decisions are no better than chance, although they feel themselves as major experts. It's an illusion of expertise.
Julian, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say what they are getting immediate feedback on, of course, is how well what they said has gone down with the public. And this is something they do respond to. So in a sense, what they are becoming experts on all too much is on short-term popularity. And isn't that another problem with which affects the decision-making, perhaps?
We can't get an answer on that right now, Julian, because we have to move on in our discussion, but it's a good one. Daniel Kahneman, thank you. Well, Julian, I mean, you've... in your books, I've been challenging the idea that we possess a kind of single self, a united self. And we've been talking a lot about, you know, how humans operate, how we think of ourselves, how our behaviour works. You argue that we're a kind of a bundle, we're a dynamic, ever-changing bundle. Can you explain what you found about the self?
Well, that's right. I mean, the broad view is not original, which I think is its great virtue, because it's actually a view which you can find in ancient Buddhist thought, you find it in Western philosophy, in the likes of John Locke and David Hume, and increasingly you're also finding it being backed up by findings in neuroscience. And the view is quite a simple one, really. It's that common sense seems to suggest that whatever you are, there is something which makes you you, if you like, an essence or a core. People use different terms for it. Something which is the same and continues to exist from moment to moment. But there is another view, which is that there is no permanent core or essence, that you are, if you like, the bundle, the collection, the flow of experiences and memories that go on over time. And obviously these take place within the single brain and the single body, and they're related to each other, so there's a strong sense of unity which comes from them. But nevertheless, it's important for various reasons to remember that you are the collection of your parts, like everything else is. There is no kind of like pearl of you at the centre of it, this hard core which remains unchanging.
And you think that it's really important to realise it's the situation, the kind of changing situations we're in, which kind of form ourselves going through life?
Well, I think you can overstate the importance of situation, actually. I think the most important thing is simply to accept the fact that there is this flow and lack of core for various reasons. I mean, first of all, just having a truthful picture of the world. I mean, some people find this idea strange, by the way, but I really don't think you should. Think of everything else. Think of what your watch, think of a water molecule. In every case, you do not think there is something, a watch or a water, which has parts attached to it. You know full well that a water just is hydrogen and oxygen. You know that your watch just is all the watch parts collected together. For some reason, when it comes to thinking of ourselves, we like to have the idea that, as well as all the bits which make us up, there is something which has them in some way. This is an odd way of thinking. And the importance of giving that up is, well, for various things, but I think the most important thing is that it's important to recognise that we lack this permanence, because it's part of a broader importance of accepting the impermanence of all things. Now, I know that might
sound... are sounding like a philosopher there, Julian.
Yeah. I'm sounding not so much like a stereotype of a Western philosopher, actually. I'm sounding a bit more like you might call the sort of, you know, the sort of more Eastern philosophy and the mystic. But it's not a mystical view at all. When you talk about the impermanence of all things, you're not talking about anything which is strange or mystical or spiritual. You're actually talking about our best understanding of the physical universe.
Well, I just want to kind of clarify one other key aspect of your thinking about self, which was this idea that you can distinguish us into sort of the passive character and the active character. Can you explain a bit more about that?
Oh, yeah, well, this perhaps does relate partly to perhaps what Daniel's talking about as well. Yeah, I think when... OK, so let's take character. This is an interesting one as well. One of the problems with thinking of ourselves of having these core essences is that we think things like our character and our personality are set in stone. Now, I think it's true that we can't just be anything we want to be. I mean, clearly people are born with certain dispositions. But there is a variability. And when I talk about passive and active, I think we've got to appreciate the fact that there are some things about the way we are which are just there through accidents of our genes, our upbringing, the way we are. But there are other aspects of our character which are there, at least in part, because we've either tried to nurture them in ourselves, or we've actually tried to, you know, nurture things that are already there, strengthen them and reinforce them, or we've actually tried to build characteristics in ourselves which perhaps didn't come naturally to us. So when we're thinking about our characters, I think it's very helpful to remember that they have these kind of passive aspects, the things we've just inherited and have just gone along with. But we also have this active side. It's about the sense in which we can construct ourselves to a certain extent, and that being who we are is a creative act as well as just a discovery.
Because we've been talking about the way politicians make decisions, I'm quite interested, Naira, with you first, in taking this idea of, can a politician kind of construct a better self for themselves? Is that a key part of what makes a great leader?
What I would take from what Julian is saying is that who a politician chooses as their peers is enormously important to the judgments and decisions that they make. I can think of instances of leaders who have, for example, remarried somebody with a completely different sort of ethical or moral compass on the world, and who have subsequently started making very different decisions.
And can you give us an example?
No, I won't give examples. I think it's invidious. But the thing I stress as a university professor of people who often go into public life is that it's really important who you choose as your so-called friends and peers, because they become part of your moral compass. And it can't be an accidental set of choices, because if you know that this person that you're calling a friend is making decisions which you think are unethical, don't forget that they become a benchmark for what you do.
They've
so I think
the
in political life, you know, the circumstances are important to engineer. But I do also respond to Julian's point by saying, yes, but hold on, we're not entirely fluid, are we? Think of how many times we say to ourselves, oh, people never change. You know, she is just as she was when she was 4 years old. I recognize that person. There's that essence which hasn't changed all their life.
Daniel.
You know, you didn't mention, Julian, let me stand up for my discipline. You didn't mention psychology. And actually, the topic that you discuss is a topic that has been extensively studied. And you're right. The very first people do assume that there is an essence. And one phase in psychological research about 40 years ago was to deconstruct that notion by showing that people are honest in the same in one situation and cheat in another. And across situation, there is very little consistency. But we now have a more balanced view, I think. And there are traits in which people do not change, in which there is consistency across the life cycle. And you mentioned 4 years old. There is very well-known research by Walter Michel on what is called the marshmallow test. And it's the ability of a child to sit in front of two marshmallows or Oreo cookies for 15 minutes in a room all by himself or herself and not touch the cookies. At any time, the child can have one for the asking by ringing a bell. But if the child waits for 15 minutes, she will get two. And it turns out that children who wait 15 minutes are very different 25 years later. They are less likely to take drugs. They are more likely to have completed university. There are major differences between them. So there is some consistency, an important consistency.
This is The Forum from the BBC World Service. Now time for our 60-second idea to change the world. And our offering this week comes from the Nobel Prize-winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman. Daniel, you have just 1 minute to win me over, Samira Ahmed, and my other two guests, Professor Nairi Woods and philosopher Julian Bajini. And of course, you, the BBC World Service audience. So if you're ready, Daniel, your minute starts now.
My idea to make the world a better place is to have the reduction of suffering rather than the maximization of happiness as an objective of social policy. Suffering is easier to measure than happiness, and it is also easier for society to accept that it is the business of government to reduce suffering rather than to promote pleasure and satisfaction. We tend to be focused on happiness because of an accident of language, which also causes us to think of beauty more easily than we think of ugliness, and to think of depth rather than shallowness, or intelligence rather than stupidity. Suffering is not just the absence of happiness. It is defined and measured by feelings that people would want to avoid: grief, worry, loneliness, despair, boredom, exhaustion, and physical pain. So a focus on alleviation of physical and mental suffering has immediate implications for policy, and I propose that leaders should be judged on how they can promote life, liberty, and the reduction of suffering. It will lead to a happier world.
Perfectly done in a minute. Daniel, lots of governments are currently paying more interest to the idea of measuring happiness. The UK government is one of them. So it's interesting that you would suggest focusing on misery.
It actually has consequences for measurement. If you try to ask people questions that emphasize the positive, like how happy are you, you are not going to get the same responses as you would if you asked people about their pain and about suffering. And so the focus of the question that you ask is going to have an effect on your conclusions and on what you measure. And the definition of an objective as increasing the happiness, average happiness, is quite different from a focus on reducing the suffering of the people who suffer. There is vast inequality in society in the amount of suffering. A minority of us do most of the suffering, and worrying about them is a possible objective for social policy.
And so how would you measure misery in your index then?
Well, misery is relatively easy to measure because you can measure it in surveys and in questions, and we know that those surveys are pretty good. You can ask people about the amount of physical pain that they have experienced, about the sadness, the grief, the anger, about how much they have worried, and how lonely they have been. And all these are sources of suffering. All these are related, we know, to health and disease. And there is, I think, good reason to want to alleviate it.
Julian, are you convinced about the idea of a misery rather than a happiness index?
Absolutely. For a couple of reasons, actually. I mean, it does echo very much, I think, what Amartya Sen, another Nobel Prize-winning economist, said about justice, which is that actually, you know, rather than focus too much on trying to create an ideal of justice, which we'll never agree on what it is, you know, we should just actually go to getting rid of manifest injustice, which everyone can spot. And also, we probably have more practical ways of alleviating it. And the other thing is that the reason it's better to focus on alleviating suffering than it is on promoting happiness is that, you know, happiness, well-being, these are not only vague terms, but they're pluralistic ones. What I mean is that people have different ideas about what would make their life happy, what would make their lives go well. And we really shouldn't be getting too involved in trying to direct people's particular choices. But when it comes to the things which really make people suffer, again, we kind of know what they are and we can agree on them. So I think this promotes a healthy openness towards the way in which people fill out their lives. But it also gives us something really practical to focus on that we can actually agree around.
Now, it's interesting that in Britain, you know, the government has been accused of a kind of PR trick by talking about a happiness index rather than measuring inequality, for example. I wonder how far a misery index would help governments or just make them less likely to be re-elected.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I wonder, Danny, if this is a way to sort of repackage the argument for redistribution. I was very struck in your latest book that you talk about people with household incomes, I think, of less than $60,000 are unhappy, and they are progressively more and more unhappy depending on how little they've got. Whereas what you report very interestingly is that over $60,000, it's a flat line. Once you've got what it takes to stop stressing about your money, then actually your happiness doesn't increase with your income. So I wonder, you know, firstly, is there anything more to reducing misery than that? Is this an argument in the end for reducing that sharp end of inequality? And I guess my other reflection is that I guess the argument for thinking about happiness is that happiness gives you greater resilience against the causes of misery, that somebody who is happy is more likely to deal with hardship. But
that's a legitimate concern, isn't it? That you make people focus on the negative and it sends people on a downward
spiral. I think suffering is a fact, and that actually a minority of people report suffering. It's about 20%. Most people are happy most of the time. The poor, at least in the United States, which is what I have studied in detail, the poor are truly unhappy. I mean, and they're unhappy because being poor makes everything worse. It is worse to be sick if you are poor. It is worse to be divorced if you are poor. It is worse to be unemployed, of course. Every misfortune of life is worsened by poverty. But it's not the only thing. Mental illness is a major source of suffering. The loneliness of the old is a major source of suffering. And so you would be guided to different policies, I think, if you thought of looking at the pockets of intense suffering and dealing with those, rather than as at increasing the overall level of happiness of people who, to begin with, are pretty happy.
Thank you, Daniel. And if you're listening and would like to add your thoughts, do get in touch. Responding to last week's 60-second idea by the singer Clarence McFadden, Scamp Bell posted on our Facebook page, "I like the idea of a 48-hour global celebration of unity, unconnected with our governments. A silent time for the entire globe could be coordinated in this time frame." You can also tweet us, BBC The Forum, or email us. All details of our address are on our webpage. Just search for BBC Forum. You're listening to The Forum from the BBC World Service. Now, a few days ago, as the Italian financial crisis was unfolding, the government in Rome turned to the International Monetary Fund, not for money, but for more frequent monitoring of their accounts. Nari Woods is the dean of the new Blavatnik School of Government at Oxford University. You've been studying and advising global institutions such as the IMF for many years. How much can they do to calm troubled economies?
Well, the IMF can play the role of policeman that no one else wants to play. It's very difficult for individual countries to help each other out because the money's easy to give, but the conditionality is difficult to impose. In the old colonial days, you could probably send in the gunboats and, you know, expropriate a government refusing to pay its debts. You can't do that in the modern world. And so with a Germany and a France that are unwilling and reluctant to use their resources to bail out Greece or Italy because they know their populations will say, well, why should we, careful, saving, hard-working citizens, bail out these profligate southerners? That argument can be avoided when governments channel their money through the IMF and say, right, well, it's not us that's imposing conditionality on you, Italy or Greece. It's the IMF, which is why one part of the solution I think we'll probably see emerge is for the Europeans to put their funding into the IMF and to let the IMF take the full brunt of the anger of populations having to really contract their economies, take large pay decreases, structural adjustment, as it would be called by those working in the fund.
Isn't there a growing influence of individual regions? I mean, that they're becoming more important than the kind of international governance of organisations like the IMF?
That was a very popular thought a decade ago. And when, you know, the IMF started talking about new relationships with regional organisations, it wasn't thinking of a new relationship with the European Union at the time. It was thinking about a new relationship with the Asian economies that had just had a financial crisis. But I think what this crisis shows is that regions, there are certain things regions can't do on their own, not least because it can happen that all countries in a region can suffer a crisis at the same time. And so just as you buy an insurance policy, you spread the risk, so the IMF spreads the risk. So it does two things for countries. It acts as a safeguard of their resources, and then it can apply conditionality and be the policeman of how those resources are actually used.
Now, organisations like the IMF are staffed by what we call technocrats. You know, they're not politicians. They're supposed to be more even-handed and neutral. And we're actually seeing more technocrats brought into making, you know, national decisions. I mean, in Italy, for example, is it true that their decisions are more neutral? Are they even-handed?
No, I don't think that those three things go together. A technocrat has a particular kind of training. So a very large number of the staff in the IMF have a PhD in economics from quite a small range of universities, and that's their way of thinking. They have a belief, or they did have a belief, and certainly until the financial crisis, in equilibrium models, in certain, you know, economic precepts about how the economies work and how adjustment and reform will work in an economy. But that doesn't mean it's neutral. In fact, the studies of the research of the organisation show that very often the research of the organisation has been deployed behind what is in essence an ideological belief. So technocratic, yes, but that doesn't mean neutral and impartial.
Daniel, I mean, this is exactly what you were looking at in your book. I mean, do you think that having a PhD in economics makes you better qualified to make these kinds of decisions?
Well, I mean, it makes you better qualified than the average citizen. It doesn't mean that you're not guided by your ideology, and there are very large differences among PhDs in economics, let alone between economists and the rest of us.
Julian, you know, there's so much public concern at the moment about who's in charge, who's making all these decisions, often using taxpayers' money, whether via the IMF or the Eurozone. Do you think that people are challenging the assumptions that the IMF knows best?
Well, I mean, I think the idea that the IMF knows best is something which I think in popular culture has been challenged perhaps too much. But I think what's really interesting about this, and I think something Nairi's talked about elsewhere, is the way in which all these things are showing the real difficulties we have at the sort of different levels of responsibility, sort of national, transnational, international. And Nairi, in one of your talks I heard, you were making this point that Sarkozy said that, you know, come the financial crisis, a lot of these international banks very quickly found their passports, so meaning that they'd previously been acting as though they, you know, couldn't be constrained by national governments, so they couldn't be allowed to do that. That was somehow an infringement of their multinational status. And yet, when the problems came, they turned to their national governments to bail them out. And I think there's a real issue here around, you know, well, where does responsibility lie in a world in which you have both, you know, people employing people on a particular high street in a particular city, and yet these decisions are going around the world, and you've got national governments, transnational agreements? I mean, it's a huge issue now, so it's a big thing to throw at you.
It's a really important one, because it goes to the heart of what we should expect from leaders. You know, what global leaders in the main industrialised economies have done for the last two decades is create a whole set of rules about market opening. They have opened borders to finance, and in so doing, they've created an extraordinarily interdependent system where the collapse of Lehman Brothers quickly ricocheted all over the world. What they have never balanced that market opening exercise with is prudential regulation. In other words, they've said to banks, you can take as many risks as you like right across the world, but they've never increased the responsibilities on banks at the same time. They've divorced risk from responsibility. So what we now need to see global leaders do is actually to create a global prudential regulation. In other words, to say to banks, you take the risks, you've got to protect yourselves against those risks at the same time. In other words, you take the risks, you've got to take responsibility. And because so many banks are now global, those rules actually have to have a global element. That's what's so important when we see the G20 and groups of leaders coming together now. We can see already that they risk not focusing on this one key task, which is to manage globalization so as to ensure that those for whom markets have been opened across the world now take full responsibility for the global interdependence of their actions. And that means some pretty robust global financial regulation, which sadly we're not seeing yet.
The ideology that underlies a great deal of decision-making recently, of economic decision-making, is the belief that markets work. And, you know, that certainly was, you know, Alan Greenspan's famous confession that his framework was wrong. His framework assumed that agents such as banks are rational agents that act to protect themselves. This is a fallacy. And there are both loyalties and disloyalties that are involved, the loyalties to local countries and the disloyalty of agents who actually take risks on behalf of their institution that affect the entire world.
When we look at the kind of global crisis, and more specifically the one in the Eurozone going on right now, you know, it does seem it was brought about by a kind of case of collective blindness as well as kind of ideological drive. Are we still blind? What do all the panellists think? I don't know if you want to take that first, Daniel.
I think undoubtedly we're still blind. You know, Nassim Taleb has argued very eloquently for the unpredictability of the future. And, you know, what we see in Europe at the moment looks incredible in terms of blindness.
Julian.
In order to come to a proper understanding of this, we need to just take the real kind of impartial look at it. You know, we really need that system two thinking, which is very aware of all the different kind of prejudices we have, which are just shifting our minds, our thinking in ways which... So we think we're being rational and we think we're having a considered view about it, but actually our prejudices are constantly interfering and stopping us seeing things straight, I think.
Nari, briefly.
Yes, I think the best way to get to that, which Danny and Julian have argued, the best way to get to that is in a global forum, and that's because it's when one government, you know, with all the blindness that it has, is forced by other governments to really think about what it's doing and to think about the consequences for themselves and on others, that they'll get clarity. I remember Robert McNamara, who led the United States in the Vietnam War, writing a book in which he mentioned in passing that if only America had listened to Europe in the 60s, if only they had listened to Europeans telling them, you're getting it wrong, they would have made wiser decisions. Well, now it's very important for Europe and the United States to be listening to China, to be listening to Brazil, to be listening to countries which have very different interests and hearing what they have to say and using that to test the direction they're setting.
Nari Woods, Julian Bergini and Daniel Kahneman, thank you to all three of you. Next week, trees and how their individual personalities exert such a strong force on our lives, with guests including the novelist Tracy Chevalier. But for now, from me, Samira Ahmed, and all of us here on the Forum team, have a good week. And as we usually do, to give you a moment to reflect on our discussion, I'll leave you with birdsong from Nari Woods' native New Zealand.
If you've enjoyed this BBC podcast, why not try others, such as Start the Week with Andrew Marr? To find out more, visit bbc.com/podcast.